RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time now for our Legal Hub Wednesday morning here at RCR. Two things we're going to talk about this morning with two, well, one's not really a guest because she comes on a lot, but the other is a guest. Mary Nelson will be with us to talk about anti-money laundering and combating the financing of terrorism. Last time Mary was on, we're talking about tax. Hi, Mary. Good to have you back.
Hi, Paul. Thank you for having me.
We'll get to that in just a moment, if that's all right.
Yes.
First, Katie, hi, how are you doing?
Good morning. Good morning, listeners. How is everybody today?
We're good and kind of excited because the terms of reference for phase two of the COVID inquiry were released yesterday. I can't think of anyone better to give first impressions than you. What do you say?
Interesting. So not only did the terms of reference for phase two land, so did the two new commissioners.
Oh, okay.
So it is a very interesting time. And this is, I'm just putting my toe into today's Legal Hub just to give people a bit of an update to let them know there will be more coming because there is a lot more to unpack. But in addition to Grant Illingworth KC, we now have got two new appointments, Judy Margaret Kavanagh and Anthony Murray Hill. Anthony Murray Hill looks like to be, he was a former Health and Disability Commissioner, actually resigning at the end of 2020, which is a very curious time.
Okay.
And has also been, I think, in-house counsel for the New Zealand, Health New Zealand or Department of Health. So really interesting, just unpacking that and any possible biases that there might be around that. We've touched on bias before. Bias is a situation where even if it's apprehended or actual, there is a risk that person's prior experience might be such that they have a particular preference for deciding in the favour of a particular way. And in this case, you know, if this is a former client and a lot of the public health directives came from the Ministry of Health, is this gentleman properly independent enough to be giving critique? So I'm working through all of that. I'm throwing out my initial thoughts, having seen what I've seen. Grant Illingworth, KC, has been around for a while. He was an appointment to help assist a month ago, the current commissioners to complete their report. I'm not sure quite how that works because, of course, Alia and Claire and I were in front of the commissioners again earlier this month. And Mr. Illingworth KC was not around and didn't appear. So we appeared just solely before the phase one commission there. Grant Illingworth actually authored an article, I think it was in the Herald, on the 30th of March 2020. And in that article, he made some quite good overtures about, you know, the power of lockdown, the balancing of human rights and things like that. And a lot of those comments I felt that he made in that article were comforting. I just don't know where he's been since.
We've had him on this program. I interviewed him about the, whatever they call it, the End of Life Bill, the Act.
Oh, what did you find? How did you find him?
I found him, well, who am I? Find a description. I found him very thoughtful and I agreed with him on a lot of what he said. This going back a while now, you know, was I impressed? I thought he brought up the issues that I would be concerned about, but in a legal way. So that's how that went. Yeah.
Well, look, this article's behind paywall. I don't think we're breaching any issues if I release it beyond paywall and attach it to this chat. And people can have a look at it and we'll definitely do a much deeper dive into, you know, maybe an inquiry sessions on phase two now that we've got the new terms. Look, the new terms have landed. They're not as broad and far-reaching as I would expect. It's going to be interesting to see how there's going to be a mashup between phase one and phase two. And the reasons why I say that is there are still some exclusions. So they're not allowed to talk about the epidemiology of COVID-19 or the variants, which I think is interesting because, of course, New Zealand is at the bottom of the world and we're 6 months behind the Northern Hemisphere. And, you know, I think variants were a key part of, well, we probably didn't need to lock down given that, you know, we were getting the Delta and Omicron phases. But that's not open for discussion and they're excluded from talking about it. So I think that that's interesting. Let me touch on the what they can talk about, which I think is important, and in case people haven't had a chance to see it yet, and then I'll go into my critique. So the things that they can talk about are the use of vaccines in response to COVID-19, specifically mandates, approvals of specific COVID-19 vaccines. And remember, we actually only had one which we brought into the country, even though in provisional approval, not full approval, was granted to the other providers such as Moderna and Johnson & Johnson. And then we've got vaccine safety, including monitoring and reporting of adverse reactions. We also have the imposition and maintenance of lockdowns during the period, and then specifically the national lockdowns in August and September, and the extended lockdowns in Auckland and Northland in September. This is 2021. The procurement, development and distribution of testing, tracing technologies and non-pharmaceutical public health materials, specifically the impact of private sector involvement or non-involvement. And then we're looking at key decisions. And so key decisions is a decision that has the potential actual significant impact on large numbers of people. So we're looking their spotlight on the politicians and the public health measures that were being issued. And then there's various things that they must do and assess. And we're talking about social division, isolation, health, education, inflation, debt, and their business activity, so economy. So social, health, education and economy were the sort of things that they need to focus on and considering those things. But this is my kicker. They're being asked to consider mandates, but the inquiry must only consider key decisions made on these matters between February 2021 and October 2022. I think that that's a short period, possibly a short period of time for considering fully the consequences.
Okay.
Now, February 2021 is interesting. That's when the vaccines were approved. Sorry, not approved. That's when the rollout started for adults and elderly people. And we've got, what, roughly an 18-month period that they're going to be considering. I just felt that that period was, putting a period of time on it, I felt was interesting, given that the repercussions that we've been feeling, the 222 businesses that shut last or were placed into liquidation last month. I think that there's just a lot more in it. So I thought that the time frame limitation was interesting, but perhaps realistically there needs to be a sensible approach to, you know, we could go on forever and, you know, you would and should be able to identify the significant damage that has been done.
Okay. The variance thing. Been thinking about that all the way through what you're just saying there.
It's excluded. The epidemiology of COVID-19 and the variants.
Why would that be?
I don't know. It was excluded in phase one as well. And I think I capped on about it quite a bit. I think it's really important. I think it goes to the point of lockdowns in September and October. And I think it's a really important part of the history that should not be excluded. It actually needs to be dealt with, needs to be acknowledged. Wuhan and Alpha strains of COVID were very different from the latter strains. And that's what SARS infections often do, is they become more infectious but less killy.
Yeah. Yeah, lethal.
Yes.
Yeah. Killy.
Killy.
Okay, well, I guess we just have to digest all that, but
heaps to unpack, heaps to find out more about these commissioners. You know, it's interesting. I think for me, being Legal Hub, the jury's still out. But I'll tell you what, they'll be reminded regularly and they will be held to account.
Can you see the effect of...
Yes, go Mary.
How do they choose these commissioners?
Yeah, good question.
I don't know how they identify and choose them. I would love to be a commissioner. It would be amazing opportunity. And I've done quite a few royal commissions before. So I did the Bushfire Royal Commission in, or the tail end of it in Australia for the Black Saturday bushfires. you know, it's an amazing opportunity to be a commissioner, I think. There will be an element of preferential choice. So Professor Blakely in the first phase, he was, you know, intentionally selected. You stack it. You really do stack it for what you want to hear and see.
Right. So what do you think was intentional about his appointment?
Professor Blakely, very pro all the public health measures, was advising and is good friends with Sir Ashley Bloomfield, loves a good lockdown. His job is around and surrounded and is about public health emergencies. And we've got an onslaught of public health people being educated and graduating. And a good way to justify your existence is to have a good reason to ensure that your public health advice is needed. So, you know, he was chosen. I think that it was a very dangerous choice to choose him. I can't comment on Mr. Whitehead or what was the first commissioner's name that resigned in December? Patricia.
I know who you're talking about. Forget the name.
Yeah, and she was a former National MP. So, look, I'm not sure the reasons for that. Perhaps they knew they were a soft pedal. But you definitely do stack a commission with commissioners on the basis of who and what you'd like them to decide and what their preferences would be. So we really need to get to the bottom of their independence and whether or not and what their positions are and whether or not they are truly, truly independent and are going to come to this with, you know, clean hands. The issue and the issue that I often reference for these things is just like the judges that we've appeared before and all the court cases that have happened, this is really the first time you've actually got court judges that are having to make decisions about things that they've been involved in. You know, we've all lived through COVID.
We've all got
a view. And, you know, we all, you know, people made their decisions based on their view. A lot of people have changed their views and respect to them.
They all wore masks. All the judges wore masks.
Exactly right. And Mary, I'm sure you probably went to court over that time. We had situations where people were excluded from court. They had only vaccinated juries. You know, is that a true representation of New Zealanders?
Not really.
They insisted on vaccine passes at the door. You know, we helped hundreds of people at MSD that were facing real significant issues. And the irony is this is the, you know, a court is our third estate. They are supposed to be independent, upholding the rule of law. And I thought the cornerstone principles of legal tradition and common law and history, and here they were rolling out what I would perceive to be abhorrent breaches of the Human Rights Act. So it's, you know, it was incredible times. And so I think that that's what we need to keep in mind and think about.
Well, lawyers didn't have to be mandated. That was one of the interesting things. And I thought, well, that would be a problem if they had mandated lawyers. But firms had mandates in place, so.
And that's exactly right. They all felt the pressure, and they all employed and brought in policies which required staff to be vaccinated. And so it was kind of like the wash up. If the government couldn't force people to be vaccinated under a mandate because they couldn't identify it, then there was just this immense pressure placed on employers to finish off the job that the government had done. And they made that really easy by making health and safety protocols or decisions to make vaccination compulsory within the workplace, really low-hanging fruit. They changed the Employment Relations Act and it included a new schedule. And, you know, the government did everything that it could while not looking like the enforcers of mandates to actually enforce mandates. And all of these employers willingly and happily
Boy,
did this without conducting their own due and proper risk assessments, which they were all obliged to do, and they were obliged to assess them on the basis of their staff, and they were actually required to go into and investigate whether or not they were introducing a bigger risk into the workplace. And I'll tell you what, the amount of people that I help nowadays that turn around and say, I did it just so I could keep working. And guess what? A lot of these people now can't work because they're so badly injured. Yes. And that is just, you know, you might never be able to work again. And that's what is just such a severe and significant tragedy. Like it just, it beggars belief. It really does.
Just a quick question from me, Katie, on this. Are there echoes, are there signs of the people's terms in those references or whatever?
Yeah.
There are?
I see them. Look, there is very much the desire to highlight and pull together and identify those phrases that were included in both the New Zealand National Coalition Agreement and the ACT and National Coalition Agreement. So there are definitely those overtures, but you can definitely see that the people's terms had permeated that. And I think we should all be really, really proud of what we've achieved. And, you know, it doesn't stop there. We're going in hard. They will be given every bit of information that they need to make an appropriate decision and a suitable decision, and one that will actually reinstall some faith of New Zealanders into what's happened over the last 4 years, because nobody trusts the government. Mm. Even those that willingly did and took and still do take. I think there has been a real mistrust created. And once you have that, revolutions happen.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything more to say, Katie? Are you going to kind of dip out at this point?
That wasn't a short update. I'm sorry.
That's okay. We wanted to hear.
Very interesting.
Absolutely.
Look, I'm looking forward to it. I'm diving into every sort of crevice and crack within these the new terms, and also the new commissioners. So I'll make sure that article's attached from the Herald. Encourage everyone to have a look at it. Make up your mind for yourself. We're not here to tell you what to think, but it is it's going to be interesting.
All right. Well, thank you for that.
Phase two.
We go.
Awesome.
Get ready for phase two, everybody.
Yeah, here to educate. Thank you, Katie.
Stand back. Yeah. Thank you, Katie.
Have a great morning, you guys.
Okay. Thanks for popping in.
Thanks. Bye.
Wow. Okay. Mary, let's get down to the other business. And I know about this because I have been trying to get legal. Well, I've had legal services going on in Brazil to try and arm wrestle the ownership of an old New Zealand airliner. And I've been sending progress payments, and every time almost there seems to be a hitch or a problem because it's all down to anti-money laundering. So I'm kind of aware of this issue. I managed to sort of get around them with more explanations and descriptions, etc., but it's not been smooth in many cases. So why is the world suddenly nuts about all of this? Because it never used to be a few years ago or 5 years ago or whatever, right?
Well, the transfer of funds, that what you're experiencing is enhanced customer due diligence, which is because you are, it will be the Brazilian laws, their anti-money laundering laws, but because you're transferring funds from a foreign country to a bank account in Brazil, then that bank has got their own anti-money laundering. We call it the anti-money laundering, countering the financing of terrorism. It's quite a mouthful.
It is.
It's AML, CFT, or just AML, actually. It sounds a bit like, actually, I'll just carry on. But AML.
Primarily to stop the funding of terrorism, really, is it? Because that's the really nasty bit, I suppose.
Well, I'll tell you what, because I actually wrote notes so I can do it in a order. So this whole thing, the anti-money laundering it's laws, regulations and procedures aimed at uncovering money that has been disguised as legitimate income, and then the financing of terrorism is to uncover any financing of terrorism. And so So what each person, so if you fall within the ambit of the Anti-Money Laundering Act, if you're what's called a reporting entity, because you perform certain activities defined under the AML Act, then you become a reporting entity and then you've got certain obligations. And one of the main obligation is conducting customer due diligence on your client. And so that is where you will get, so customer due diligence here in New Zealand, they would like photographic ID, such as a passport or a New Zealand driver's license. So you've got to watch little bits like that. And actually, they don't have to be current. They can be a little bit overdue if you're, you know, a little bit not current. Because it's recognised that some people actually have no ID, or, you know, their passport will lapse, or they can't drive or whatever, you know. So so you've got to provide that, photographic ID, proof of your home address, and that's standard customer due diligence. And you're supposed to say what is the source of your funds. So, like, for instance, if you sold a house and you were transferring money to Brazil and you were using the sale proceeds of a house, then you would provide the agreement for sale and purchase and the settlement statement and all of that sort of stuff. But so the whole thing started in the, like, 1970 in the US, and they introduced an act called the Bank Secrecy Act, and that was the financial institutions were required to report cash deposits of more than $10,000, collect identifiable information of financial account owners and maintain records of the transaction. And so that was the 70s. And then in 1989, the Financial Action Task Force started, and that was established by the G7, in a G7 summit in Paris in 1989, and it was to develop measures to combat money laundering. And at the beginning, it never had teeth, because actually the people that were laundering money were a lot of high up officials and that sort of stuff. So no countries really got all that interested to start with. But after the 9/11 event, then all of it changed, because they introduced financing of terrorism.
Right.
And when they introduced the financing of terrorism, and then actually, in 1989, when the Financial Action Task Force, and its acronym is FAT, which is almost impossible to say, to be honest.
Yeah, I won't ask you to say that again.
No, please don't. Anyway, that place, well, right now it's got 40 member countries. New Zealand is a member country, and over 200 jurisdictions around the world, and they comply with it. And so October 2001, the Financial Action Task Force issued 8 special recommendations on terrorist financing. And then it was about then that, and then in 2003, they revised the recommendations for money laundering. In 2004, there was 9 more recommendations for terrorist financing. And then in 2012, they revised the FAT revised all their recommendations. And the recommendations are things like, well, I'll tell you what, in New Zealand law, so under our anti-money laundering or law, AML Act, the purpose of the Act are to detect and deter laundering of the financing of terrorism, and B, to maintain and enhance New Zealand's international reputation by adopting, where appropriate in New Zealand context, recommendations issued by the Financial Action Task Force. So in other words, those 40 recommendations plus the extra ones for the financing of terrorism, they are in our legislation. So essentially the AML Act just says whatever these 40 recommendations say.
Right, yeah, okay.
And then, so when you have your customer, so if you go into a bank and you want a deposit, first of all, like for over $10,000, you've got to give a whole bunch of information, but banks will ask for it anyway. And so it starts at the top. New Zealand has a risk assessment and a compliance program for the country. And then we have our supervisor. Is this boring?
No, that's interesting. I'm always fascinated to hear how things come about.
Oh, to hear how it works. I actually find it quite interesting.
This is boring.
Hopefully not. Who's to sleep with you?
No, no.
Puts your nose in their coffee. Anyway, no. Okay, so here we go. Okay,
all right.
So now I've lost my track because I bored myself, perhaps.
Yeah, you almost put your nose in your own coffee.
Oh, my God, I just put my nose in my own coffee.
Where were you going back to the law.
Okay, so we basically have these recommendations in our law and we have to do these things. And so it starts at the top where New Zealand has their own, we have our brand to protect. And so we will follow these laws because if we don't follow these laws, we get blacklisted. And so other countries won't trade with us. And you look at what has happened in various countries around the world when, you know, they annoy another country and, you know, a lot of things are imposed. And so
bad for business. Yep.
Bad for business, bad for the country brand. And so from the top we have them and then we have supervisors are what they're called, who monitor a different area. So we've got the Department of Internal Affairs. They are the supervisor for lawyers, accountants, money remitters, who, you know, they are a heavily targeted industry when it comes to AML by the DIA. And then we have the Financial Markets Authority, FMA, and they monitor share brokers and that sort of stuff. And then we have the Reserve Bank and they monitor the trading banks and them. And then we have the last thing we have is something called the Financial Intelligence Unit, which is a division of the New Zealand Police, and they analyse transactions, bank records, they'll source money, you know, follow wherever it's gone and trace the and at the beginning when all this was set up, so our act is called the AML Act 2009, but actually it wasn't implemented until 2013, and it was done in stages. It started with banks and money remitters and I think the share brokers and things, and then in 2018, then phase two was implemented and it included lawyers and accountants and other types of institutions, high-value dealers, which is an interesting subset in itself. That is art, jewellery, anything that you would be selling, boats.
Ferraris.
Yes, cars, Ferraris, if you're going to buy one. And the interesting thing about high-value dealers is that, as I'm pretty sure it was earlier this year, they introduced a thing where high-value dealers are no longer allowed to accept cash. So if you're selling motor cars or, you know, someone can't come in and give you $10,000 for that motor car anymore, they're not allowed to accept it. And I find that quite extraordinary.
Yeah, hang on. Okay. Because that's not... That's okay. It's quite a bit of cash, but it's not a mountain of it. If you, because some people save up their cash to buy things like that, don't they?
Plenty of people have plenty of cash, and you know there is nothing. Cash is a vital part of the economy. If things go wrong, we all know what happened in Hawke's Bay last year, and
you need it.
It was 2 days where there was no ability to transact electronically. Even if you could have brought something, there was no way to get it to you. So you need
is there some way of getting at the gangs or something? Because they probably do everything in cash.
Do you know so maybe we could talk about proceeds of crime if we're going to get into cash.
Okay, well, why not?
Gangs. Yeah. Okay, so proceeds of crime. People confuse the proceeds of crime and the Anti-Money Laundering Act with each other, but they are quite different. So proceeds of crime is an act that they will say on the balance of probabilities, you've committed a crime, you know. And so that's a trick because normally for a crime, it's beyond reasonable doubt. So the balance of probabilities is 50-50, you might have committed a crime. And then one of the Financial Action Task Force recommendations is that you target tax evaders. And so tax evasion is a crime. And so but there's civil penalties for tax evasion as well. What I actually have a case right now, as a matter of fact, is where the police are saying that this family committed tax evasion by not paying returning rental income that they received on these properties. And actually, IRD was already doing an investigation, but the police jumped in. And these people have never been prosecuted for tax evasion. Partway through this whole eight-year matter, as a matter of fact, the IRD applied civil penalties for tax evasion. And so then immediately that they've done that, police are like, well, there you go, they committed tax evasion, therefore we can take everything they've profited from in their tax evasion. There happens to be many millions of dollars restrained by the official assignee for this particular people, and so the IRD want to get their hands on that. But the other thing about proceeds of crime is that it's because it's a civil thing, it also applies for health and safety. And there is the Salter case that you might have heard about. And it is Salter's cartage. And in 2015, I've got the article open on the paper. So a young guy went to work and he was welding, and the tank, he was welding on a 96,000.
Yeah, I've heard about this.
Tank. Okay, and it exploded. Yeah. So these people are being done under proceeds of crime, because they're saying that was always faulty. You knew it was faulty. That's a health and safety risk. You could be prosecuted under the Health and Safety Act. Therefore, it's a crime. Therefore, everything that you've made since you knew that it was a crime is a proceed from your crime, and we're taking it. That's how proceeds of crime works. So,
okay. What do you mean they could bury their business?
Or
has it already?
So in this article that's just been in the paper, the police application for a forfeiture has been set down tentatively for a seven-week hearing in the High Court in October 2024, and they are going for all their assets, which is $10 million worth of property. And I've got this in 2021 High Court decision. On an aspect of the Salter's case, Justice Palmer noted that the proceeds of crime regime had not previously been applied to what he described as an ordinary commercial business that had committed hazardous substance or health and safety offences. And so the proceeds of crime and AIM, people get them confused. They think they're the same thing, but they're not. Proceeds of crime was in these 40 recommendations by the Financial Task Force that countries should have ways of getting your money laundering, if you're financing terrorism, ways of getting it. However, in New Zealand, our police have morphed it into health and safety. And basically, anything that is a crime.
That doesn't sound too fair to me.
Well,
but what do I know?
I don't think
I guess there are circumstances that it may be, but it seems a bit like overreach.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting problem with tax as well. If you commit tax evasion, the civil penalty is 150%. And under the proceeds of crime legislation, it's like you need to benefit. And if you have committed tax evasion for $100,000, and they apply a civil penalty of $150,000, then there is no benefit in your tax evasion. You only benefit from tax evasion if you're not caught. But once you're caught, you're no longer going to benefit because of IRD. Yep. And so that's the other problem. So, but yeah, I think there is certainly overreach. I think that the police will give anything a go.
Shouldn't they be chasing around the guys doing ram raids and things like that? Just saying. I just wonder if this is also to kind of make it easier for people. If you have a digital ID, no problem. Everything's solved.
Actually, I've been looking at digital ID today as well.
Okay.
Because one of the things about the
anti-money laundering, but you can hear them using that as the convenience argument. That's my point. You know, it's have a digital ID. You don't need to go through any of this. It's just it's all smoothed over.
That's how they try and sell it. I looked at the US, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the UK. All the countries sell it the same way: a one-stop convenience shop.
There you go.
And they all say in our thing, in New Zealand, we've got something called the Trust Framework.
Oh, the Trust Framework. Yeah. The Trust Framework. Yeah.
Anyway, and it's like all the things, and it says consent is always required. So basically, I think a company that wants to do digital ID service, and there are plenty of them out there, as a matter of fact. There is, for AML, there's a company called, I do AML audits, actually, because they have to be, you know, have to be audited every few years and tell people the history of AML and things. Anyway, they... First AML is a company that provides biometric testing. And so you will sign up with if you are a reporting entity and you don't want to have to go through all the hoops and everything to do it, you can send it to a third party and they will do this for you. And so I've seen quite a few of what it is. And so you'll stand there with your passport and you've got a, I don't know, have you ever done this? I've actually never done it.
I think I have, yeah. I think I have.
Yeah. Actually, you might have had to have been doing it for these transactions for Brazil. If you were sending money, they would want to
No, I've done it all online. I haven't had to do that. But I think when I went to the States, I had to kind of stand in front of something. And
isn't that interesting, traveling?
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's been going on for a while, but I think the technology's progressively got more sophisticated, you know.
Yes, and I was listening to a really interesting podcast of Tucker Carlson and someone, I can't remember this guy, but I must find it because he was insanely interesting. And he was down on the border where all the people are going across from, sorry for segue, but where all the people are going across at the bottom of South America, right, and getting into the US. And anyway, he walked across the border and he also didn't have to show any ID. But he was watching them, all these people, pour in with no idea or anything. And as he walked through, one of the customs officers said to him, thank you, Mr. whatever his name was. So all the digital, he didn't have to show anything because he was already scanned and good to go, I would expect.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, okay. Thin end of the wedge, you could say. Mm. All right, well. It's great to have the history of AML. Well, is it a word, a pronounceable word? I think you might have AML or AML or...
I don't know.
It's just AML. Yeah. So bring really that up at a dinner conversation. Yeah.
When you both put all their keys in the basket, that's what... Cut that out, please. Yeah.
All right.
I don't go to those sorts of parties.
No, neither do I. Not anymore. No, I never went. Mary, I think we're up against time. Is there anything more you want to say about what we've been talking about here?
The one thing is the only thing is when you're banking your money and that sort of stuff, what they want to know is where the funds come from and who is the beneficial owner. Like if you walk in with your granny or someone that looks like they have no idea what they're doing and you're doing a transaction for them, you know, obviously that person is, you know, who's in control, that sort of stuff. So the banks are asking you, they are complying with their own obligations and they get pinged just like everyone else if they don't comply. So
okay,
it's,
So don't get grumpy there. That won't get you anywhere.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
So there are some funny memes.
And they'll have you on CCTV.
They will.
Yeah. 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 All right. Tax lawyer Mary Nelson, thanks for coming back on our Legal Hub. It was interesting talking tax last time. Maybe we'll get back and talk more about taxes. I wonder how the tax take's going right now out there. And
also liquidations. Actually, I did write that down. I go to the liquidations court quite a bit and it's packed.
Is it? Okay. Not surprised.
And it's actually quite depressing.
I can imagine. Yeah. Okay, well, next chat, we'll talk about liquidations. We'll have a good time with that. Oh, dear.
Fun with Mary.
Thanks for coming back on, Mary. Yeah, fun with Mary.
Total pleasure. Thank you so much, Paul.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.